on her because you did concede that the record lacked direct evidence that she had knowledge of the possession of firearms by members of the conspiracy. And what I'm wondering is if it's the government's position that in a large-scale conspiracy, a large-scale narcotics conspiracy, the possession of firearms is per se foreseeable by all participants? And if not, why her?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I could take that blanket position, and I'm not sure that the case law would support that. In this case, there is no direct evidence. The government recognizes this is a close call. There is no direct evidence of her knowledge or her presence at a time or a place where the firearms were used, but there is circumstantial evidence. For example, there's substantial evidence of Juan Martir's possession of firearms, who is somebody that Rivera had numerous contacts with, and she lived in a stash house that he paid for. There is also evidence.
Why is that evidence, though, that she was ever around the firearms or that she knew he was using them without the per se rule?
Your Honor, it's circumstantial evidence. I would say it is definitely not direct evidence, but it could be reasonably inferred from that.
Very weak. Isn't it?
Where's the circumstantial evidence of where the guns were stored in the stash house? Do we even know that they had them in the stash house?
Your Honor, there is testimony. I don't recall at this moment if there's testimony in the record about where Martir stored his guns.
And so suppose that he didn't store them in the stash house. Maybe when he came in, he had one concealed on him or something. But she never... We have no evidence that she ever saw it.
There's no direct evidence that she ever saw a firearm.
And the problem is we also don't have a... If the district court had looked at all this evidence and had made a square finding, I find that it was reasonably foreseeable to Defendant Rivera that firearms were used, I would have a much greater comfort level with this enhancement, because that's what district judges are supposed to do. They're supposed to, with their greater familiarity with the record, make those calls. But she never utters those words.
Your Honor, I think... The district, we do recognize that this is a close call. But I do believe that the district court's decision that it was reasonably foreseeable to her is supportable by the record, by both the trial record and the sentencing record.
But do we know the district court focused on reasonable foreseeability as a factual matter? Where do we see a real analysis of that issue?
Your Honor, again, I can't recall the precise wording of the sentencing transcript.
It's not a lengthy discussion.
However, there is still evidence in the record of these firearms and, for example, of Rivera's contact with individuals who did have firearms. And as I said before, we recognize that this one is a close call, but I think
what difference would it have made? Do you know off the top of your head, or is that unfair?
What difference would it have made if she'd had the 2-point reduction? Mm-hmm. I don't, Your Honor. Yeah. I apologize.
But all of this is assuming that she is not bound by a 120-month mandatory
minimum. Correct, Your Honor. Which is an argument that we made at sentencing, but we did not appeal, that the 120-month mandatory minimum should apply to her.
So do you think it still does?
Your Honor, I do believe the jury found the 5-kilogram verdict, but I recognize that the government did not appeal that issue. But there was a specific jury verdict on this issue. If I can briefly return to the claim regarding the cooking of the 25 kilograms of crack cocaine at the apartment, I think it appears the court understands the government's position on this issue, namely that this is 25 kilograms out of 350. The guidelines, it's not a sufficiency of the evidence issue. There is ample evidence to support the 5 kilograms in the Apprendi verdict form. A level 38 is as high as you go in the drug guidelines, and that's 150 kilograms. So this 25 kilograms is really meaningless. However, I do believe that the jury was very much entitled to credit the testimony of this lay witness, and the defense position that somehow it contradicts with the evidence of the expert witnesses is simply incorrect. The expert witnesses leave open the possibility that this crack could have been cooked and the apartment could have subsequently been cleaned, and that is made more likely by the fact that the defendant Majanowski and his girlfriend Alina Liss, who lived in the apartment, became aware of the government's investigation inadvertently through an error by an AT&T telephone employee who contacted the defendant Majanowski to ask a question about, I believe, a pen register, not realizing that Majanowski was one of the targets of the investigation, but simply seeing that he was a Chicago police officer. So there were approximately 2 to 3 months then when they had notice before the government came in and did this test.
I thought, though, that the defense position was that if they had, in fact, cleaned it to the standards that the expert was saying it would need to be cleaned, all of the paint would have been stripped off the walls, and that perhaps might have been noticeable when you walked in.
Your Honor, I don't believe so. There is testimony about you would need to use certain specific solvents. I can't remember off the top of my head what the name of the solvent was, but it's not necessarily paint thinner. And in addition, there was also an error in the...
Basically an organic solvent, you know, like turpentine or anything.
And, of course, co-conspirators will go to great lengths to... to protect themselves from the evidence of their crimes. The other fallacy in the defense expert's analysis was that he assumed that crack had been cooked up through, I believe, the end of 1998, when in fact the testimony was that they stopped cooking in that apartment approximately 6 months prior to, or in the summer of 1998, which is then almost 8 to 10 months prior to the tests that were done. I know the court addressed the issue of whether defendant Majanowski has waived the argument regarding the RICO conspiracy, and the government's position as set forth in his brief is that the defendant did waive this argument. It's not developed. As I understand the defendant's argument at oral argument today, it seems to be an issue of how the statute is named, and clearly it's the content of the statute that's pertinent and not the title placed upon it.
But and I thought it was also your argument that it didn't make any difference anyway, because the jury convicted Mr. Majanowski of quite a few other predicate offenses.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Which might, in light of Shidler, might be a sounder position to take.
Your Honor, that is definitely our end stop position, is that defendant Majanowski was convicted of count 2, the narcotics conspiracy, count 3, the federal extortion, and 3 substantive drug counts in addition.
All of which would support the RICO.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. And finally, with respect to Defendant Feliciano's claim that there was prosecutorial misconduct here, it is clear from the context of the record that the government is responding in rebuttal argument to a statement made by Feliciano's trial counsel. The defendant keeps stopping, saying it's not the first time a lawyer's come in here with no defense, and stops there, but that's not the whole statement. The statement continues, and jumped up with no basis and called a witness a liar. And
well, let's just say that the objection was sustained.
It was sustained, however, there was a subsequent opinion by the district court on the motion for a new trial, and that's in the record, I believe, at 527 and 628, where the district court recognized that although sustaining the objection as a cautionary measure, that it did not violate Defendant Feliciano's Fifth Amendment right to testify, that there was a context for this statement by the prosecutor, and that in any event, if it did do this, that it was harmless. However, I think if the court looks at the record, it's quite clear what happened here was the deputy superintendent of the Chicago Police testified about when he supervised Defendant Majanowski, whether or not he had formal informants. And that was between early 97 and February of 2001. He didn't recall Majanowski signing up any informants. And then Feliciano's counsel in closing called him a liar, but the information that he was using to call him a liar simply showed that Feliciano had been signed up in 1995. So the government was responding to that, and of course it is appropriate to respond and rebut a defendant's misleading argument to the jury. Even if this court were to find that somehow that it were an indirect comment, it would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because the district court did sustain the objection, told the jury to disregard the comment. The jury was correctly instructed regarding the burden of proof, including a defendant's right not to testify.
It would have been much better, though, if the government lawyer had just said it's not the first time that a lawyer's come in and jumped up with no basis and called a witness a liar. I mean, you know, that at least would have focused on exactly what you're talking about. It's the no defense part that slips. I'm sure in the heat of battle, you know, I know people say things, but it's very important not to.
Of course, Your Honor. And the government is cognizant of that, and I'm certain the trial counsel it is the heat of the battle, and a significant witness is being called a liar, and I understand the court's concern, and at the same time I would say that it's still clear, and I think the prosecutor made very clear in the course of his argument, if the court looks at it in context and even after the objection is sustained, very clear what it is he's talking about, that he's talking about this witness, this particular testimony is not as the defense has characterized it and has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not Defendant Feliciano testified. If the court has no further questions, I will simply conclude by asking that this court affirm the convictions of all of the defendants in this case.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ms. Peckren. Anything further, Mr. Price?
Judge, I just want to clarify. I'd like to clarify, Your Honor, is the position with regard to this apartment. The government has argued that it was some like 8 months later before they actually went in there. Obviously, if they didn't think they would find something, they wouldn't have gone to all that trouble, brought all that equipment in, brought this dog in to try to locate evidence. At that point of time, they clearly believed they could find something. The other reference was made to Dr. Moriarty being a lay witness. He was not a lay witness. He was certainly an expert witness, highly qualified. He was Department of Chemistry, University of Illinois. And that's about the only thing I can think of at the moment that I would wish to respond to, just to clarify that one issue.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Clancy, Mr. Shobot, your time has expired.
If it pleases the court, trial counsel for Defendant Feliciano getting up and calling one of the witnesses a liar does not give the prosecutor the right at that point to stand up and say they have no defense. They have no defense to an ordinary person that's not in these courtrooms every day and is sitting in a courtroom for the first time as a juror. When they hear they have no defense, the first thing that pops into his mind is he didn't testify. If he had a defense, he would have got up there and testified. And that's the danger that the trial court saw at the time and sustained the objection. And it's impossible to say that it's harmless when you look at the totality of the circumstances. It absolutely should be remanded for a new trial.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Clancy. Anything further, Mr. Blumenthal?
I have nothing on the bottom.
Well, thank you very much. And we particularly want to thank Mr. Shobot, Mr. Clancy, and Mr. Blumenthal for accepting the appointment in this case. And for the assistance you've been to your clients and the court. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.